From the Sky News Centre at 5, HSBC's apologised after more than a quarter of a million payments, including many people's wages, have been delayed because of a glitch. The bank's promising no one will be left out of pocket and is working hard to fix the problem. But for many, it couldn't come at a worse time. Emma Clayton says her bank holiday weekend's ruined.
My husband's received no payment, so we was planning a family holiday this weekend to Scotland. So we've got no money now to get there, so our family holiday's been cancelled now. We can't pay our rent, we can't pay council tax or any of the bills, so it's left us in a bit of a mess really.
Four people have been arrested after the bodies of 71 people were recovered from the back of a lorry found dumped in Austria. A baby girl was among the dead, who are all thought to be Syrian refugees and are believed to have suffocated. A Bulgarian-Hungarian trafficking ring is suspected of being behind the deaths. Meanwhile, 27 suspected illegal immigrants have been arrested after they were discovered in the back of a lorry at a motorway service station in Surrey. The truck's driver was also detained at... It's emerged families of the victims of the Shoreham airshow disaster may never have all their remains returned to them. A difficult recovery operation is continuing at the scene of the crash, where a vintage jet came down on top of traffic on a dual carriageway. In sport, Charlotte Proctor has won Great Britain's fourth medal of the World Athletics Championships in Beijing. She broke the national record in claiming a silver in the long jump, and she says it was the right time for her to deliver.
This is my fifth champs. I knew I had to do something big this time. I came up with that in mind, came here to compete, and it was a great competition. Atmosphere is amazing.
And a paper coffee cup used by the man who's leading the polls to become the next leader of the Labour Party has sold on eBay for £51. The item description stated that Jeremy Corbyn handed the seller the cup at the Playhouse Theatre in Nottingham. That's the latest. I'm Victoria Lawrence.
Yes, it's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news. It's Labour councillor for Brislington East, Mike Woollacott. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, killing the host. How did we allow a parasitic financial system to grow up around us? Advisor to Greece's Syriza party and author of the book of the same name, Michael Hudson, explains. And are Microsoft, Google, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, Skype and Yahoo just the front end of the US National Security Agency? As using all these shop windows to hoover up everything about us? Kevin Carhill joins us. Also, why is the Goddard inquiry into VIP paedophile child sex abuse and murder using staff from the Home Office, which is supposed to be investigating? And where were we last week? Well, we were enjoying a celebration of the life and World War II exploits of Commander Harold Goulding, DSO. But why has it taken 70 years for the officer commanding HMS North Knee, which trained the Royal Navy's elite commandos and special forces in Hailing Island, to be remembered? Plus, the one airliner that was allowed to leave otherwise closed US airspace on the afternoon of the 9/11 attacks. Who was on it and where was it heading? Plus, it's Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, it's Bristol's bank holiday two weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 14 Celsius and dry, highs of 21 this weekend, brighter on Saturday, cloudier on Sunday with some showers, sunny with a few showers on bank holiday Monday. Next week, highs of 21, fairly sunny through the week. Next weekend, it's the 5th and 6th of September, highs of 18 Celsius and fairly sunny. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news, it's Labour councillor for Brislington East, Mike Woollacott. Hi, Mike, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Hiya.
Actually, it's 2 weeks, really, isn't it? Because we didn't have a show last week. So if there's anything that, Mike, you want to contribute from the last couple of weeks, do feel free. I think we better probably start, though, by discussing what's happened with the Chief Constable, Nick Gargan. Article in the Western Daily Press, I think this is today, actually. And it says, Police Chief Nick Gargan is a victim of a witch hunt, USA MPs. This is Tina Rao in the Western Daily. Another MP has condemned the process that's led to Avon and Somerset Chief Constable Nick Gargan being asked to resign by Police and Crime Commissioner Sue Mountstevens. Charlotte Leslie, MP for Bristol North, and Mr Gargan's local MP, is a second to say that the process smacks of a witch hunt, says that analysis of fact seems to have descended into a media court disgrace. Mrs Mountstevens was recommended by the chair of the independent panel to issue Mr Gargan with a final written warning after he was found guilty of 8 counts of misconduct. But this misconduct is not sackable, Mike. So what's going on here?
Well, it is. It's trial by media, and it's quite shocking, to be honest. If a chief constable's got to be treated that way, how could anybody else be expected to be treated fairly in their workplace?
And why is this another senior member of staff who left after Nick Gargan was appointed alleged to have said, "I'm going to take Nick Gargan down when I go"? Was she one of those that made allegations against him that later turned out to be false?
Well, the police should have their own internal processes for dealing with any conduct, and I find it quite shameful that this is almost being played out like a soap opera.
Now, just as an example, say, for example, you or I were a police officer and we broke the speed limit, we were fined for speeding, that would be considered gross misconduct. So that's something which is potentially sackable, but this is something which is a more minor offence. And certainly from my understanding of what went on, these various things that Nick Gargan has done and been found, if you want, guilty of, are basically to do with sharing what essentially under data protection is too much information with the public. Now, Sue Mountstevens was elected as a kind of new broom to come into the police service in Avon and Somerset, and Nick was seen to be the man to do that. Now, part of that is being much more frank with the press and public about police activity, surely.
Well, if you're pushing the parameters of what information you're going to discuss, you're going to end up in a situation where that's going to be challenging for some people. But at the end of the day, in the interest of openness, I can't see that there's a big issue. And obviously, through the investigation that's been carried out, these have been held as relatively low-level offences, not something that will warrant summary dismissal. So they are perceived by the people who carried out this investigation to be low level, which is an adequate assessment of the situation.
It's interesting though, isn't it, that Sue is elected as an independent, in inverted commas, not from a political party, to do this kind of new broom with the old guard out, you know, what people might call the dinosaurs out, and to bring new people in. When she does, that person is then removed effectively by a kind of bullying campaign.
No, it's quite shocking, actually, to be quite honest. We live in quite a scary world at the moment.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, what do you make of all of this? I know you always tell us that you don't like these police and crime commissions anyway, but yeah, it's possible that this may have happened even if it wasn't under the previous system. If there are allegations of misconduct against a chief constable, surely he's going to have to be suspended, as Nick was.
Well, maybe, but I think I don't think you can argue that this has actually worked out terribly well. Sue Mountstevens, there was something like 14% turnout in the election, so her mandate is extremely thin. And, you know, we're talking now about people not being allowed to go on strike unless 50% of people vote for them and so on. Sue Mountstevens, independent as she is, has basically got no political base. So she's got rid of 2 chief constables in a very short space of time, for whatever reasons. But frankly, many serving police officers are going to regard the whole thing as a shambles. And it is a shambles. The politicisation of I don't accept having elected police crime commissioners. If you think about it, they haven't imposed this in Northern Ireland, and it's quite obvious why, because people would be voting for the Republican police and crime commissioner or the Loyalist police and crime commissioner, and the whole point is that policing politicised in that way. And she's an independent, but that doesn't mean anything.
Well, she
ultimately
says, Martin,
what
that
used
she's
to happen. Let me just finish. Yeah. What used to happen is there was a police committee which had representatives from across the community, from across the political spectrum, which supervised the police. And that's a much better idea than having some amateur, frankly, blundering around, creating a mess in the way that she's created.
Also, I mean, she's married with kids, but there's not a lot of talk about her husband, Sue Mountstevens, who just happens to be quite well connected with the regional elite, that is to say the Chambers of Commerce, this kind of thing. In fact, I believe he's even chaired one of the Chambers of Commerce. So we don't see anything about her husband, and it's a bit like the George Ferguson syndrome, Mike, isn't it? Independent, but how independent?
Well, at the end of the day, I mean, independency is maybe perceived as a positive thing by some people. Other people may consider you've got a loose cannon who isn't bound by any political organisation that can keep them in line.
Well, but there's the other argument, which is we're fed up with these party politics being played all the time. Actually, it's more like sort of various gangs trying to run a city. It's much better to have someone come in clean who's not part of that.
In any situation where you end up with just an individual running any organisation, you end up in a situation where you are held to their foibles in if they choose to go in a particular direction that has a negative impact on a community, such as libraries, such as a lot of issues around residents' parking zones. There's very little you can do to challenge that with the legal framework that's been put in place.
Ian Liddell Granger, a Conservative MP for Bridgewater and West Somerset, is also one of those that's been criticising this whole process. Anyway, I've invited Sue Mount Stevens onto the show next week to maybe enlighten us a bit more as to what's been going on with this. It seems a bit of a farce, really, with a very, very long suspension of the Chief Constable, who really only seems to have committed some minor offences which are not sackable offences, and the things he was originally accused of have turned out, it seems, to be inaccurate. Anyway, let's have a look immediately at one of the stories that's popped up on the news just now, on the Murdoch news you just heard, if you were listening at 5 o'clock, which is this one to do with the HSBC. Hundreds of thousands are going unpaid after a glitch at HSBT. What they call a glitch anyway, but they're getting quite a lot of these glitches, Martin, aren't we, recently?
Yeah, well, the suspicion has got to be that this glitch has got very suspicious timing. It could be that HSBC has lost an awful lot on its derivatives bets over the Chinese stock market crash this week.
Over a quarter of a million payments have been affected by this.
Yeah, but the point I'm making is that they then, you see, the amount of money involved, it seems like, you know, if they can hold on to that money, you know, the amount of money you can make by having that money in your hands for an extra 10 minutes, never mind 10 hours, is enormous. And you know, all of these people who have their payments delayed, they could in fact argue that they should be paid quite a large amount, you know, quite a substantial compensation for that. And of course, the possibility, because the casino banking side of HSBC and the retail banking side are all linked together, the suspicion has got to be that this computer glitch is in fact a manipulation. Now, I don't know whether it is.
Well, I mean, you could say use even the word fraud, maybe.
Well, indeed, if it's a deliberate, you follow my drift, if it's a deliberate manipulation, then that's just another part of the way in which the banking system has become completely non-functional.
HSBC started its life involved in the opium trade many years ago, illegal opium trade, that is, in the Far East. Mark Eddy of Interlink Scaffolding said that wages payments had left his company's account but had not reached the employees' accounts. He said, "We now have 150 irate scaffolders. Now, I wouldn't want to mess with them."
Well, at the end of the day, I mean, they're supposed to provide a professional service, aren't they? They've accepted £350 billion of taxpayers' money to keep them afloat over the past few years, and they can't even get people's wages into their bank accounts. It's quite shameful, really.
And in June, some 600,000 payments failed to reach the accounts of RBS customers. Now, we're told that digital money, electronic banking, everything's quick and efficient. Actually, it seems it's not working even as well as the old paper system used to before the 1980s.
Well, I've had situations myself where I've tried to pay my credit card and their system's down and you end up getting charged for it and end up having to have an argument with somebody on the other side of the world to get that refunded. A waste of people's time, to be honest.
HSBC are in the middle of sacking a load of people, aren't they, as well? So they would, I suppose, argue, well, this is part of a more efficient system. Sometimes it's bound to go wrong, the digital money, because we've got probably something like a tenth of the staff that we used to have 20 years ago.
Well, surely we should have a robust system rather than the cheapest.
I still come back to my initial point that these glitches are very suspicious because they always happen at a time of stress. And it's quite possible, if we think about the culture of criminality in these banks, that by doing this, that money remains in the hands of the bank. They can then give it to their traders, who can then make various bets, because the amount of money involved in that is actually quite large.
I mean, is it likely to be that HSB simply haven't had the money, that they've needed money and they haven't had the money?
This is the implication. I mean, if there had been a stock market crash last week, it's been rescued by government intervention in China, in the US and elsewhere. But if the market had been allowed to work, then HSBC could be bankrupt today as we speak. It probably is bankrupt. RBS certainly is, because they're selling the shares off for less than the government paid for them in the first place. And everybody's going along with that, but that in actual fact implies that RBS is in fact bankrupt in any technical sense. And these banks in fact are in fact bankrupt if the books were looked at properly, and they're being kept afloat by government intervention. The free market would allow them to collapse. The Tories, the government, they don't believe in the free market. They believe in bailing the banks out.
Well, we're going to have a look more at this. The talk from Michael Hudson, the author of Killing the Host, after the 6 o'clock news. But for now, let's have a listen for a couple of minutes to Steve Keane. Martin, just give us an idea of who Steve is, because I know he's written a book called Debunking Economics. He takes a very different view, doesn't he, to mainstream economists and mainstream journalists on the economy.
He's an academic, an Australian academic, who's currently based at Kingston University. And Mike may be interested to know that he signed Corbyn's letter of economists supporting Corbyn's economic policies and saying that they were basically mainstream economic thinking. And Keane is actually a pretty radical thinker. He's basically a non-neoliberal economist, let's put it that way.
Well, one of the things he said, for example, was that we need a Copernican revolution in economics. Yeah. That is to say that the universities and the journalists and the teachers and academics and the professionals all think that the sun is going around the earth, and they actually really need to understand, no, the earth is going around the sun, if they're actually going to understand real economics, because there's some very large parts of it which they write out of the equation. They say, well, this doesn't actually affect the economy. And he's talking about things like the giant financial institutions.
Yeah, he's basically, the basic argument he makes is that people may not realise this, but the textbooks think that debt doesn't matter. Because a debt owed by one person is going to be paid by somebody else, and therefore the basic theory of economics that you read in textbooks doesn't think debt matters at all.
Okay, well, let's have a listen now to what Steve has to say about a couple of issues. That is in the background of what we've been talking about. One is what's been happening in China, and the other is Greece and the Eurozone.
Germany denies it, but Germany's benefited dramatically out of the euro by locking all the countries of Europe into a fixed exchange rate with it, which means that they can't devalue against a stronger economy. That's benefited Germany enormously. It's given it a huge part of its trade surplus. So now what you're seeing with China is that China is feeling a decline in its domestic demand because its rate of growth of private debt is slowing down, and they're partially trying to get out of it by trying to boost their export demand once more and reduce their import purchases. So, yeah, you have got economic wars going on through currency.
In a way, an international crash is almost like an economic tsunami.
Yeah, but the thing is, the only real defence you've got against that is having a strong export sector. And that's one thing England hasn't got. So the main weakness England faces as a nation is not its government deficit, it's its trade deficit. And that means that you've got to, you're running like 6% of GDP deficit. That weakens you dramatically in terms of competing with countries like China and Japan and Germany and Japan that are running large trade surpluses. And you have no real way of controlling them apart from devaluing your own currency.
Now, what about things like exchange controls? Because vast amounts of trillions of pounds and dollars can run around the world at the moment in seconds, can't they?
Yeah, I mean, the whole problem has been letting finance get out of control. I think Keynes once said that finance is a good servant and a bad master. And what we've let happen is the financial sector has become the master of the global economy. And that is always a recipe for an economic crisis. Because banks make money by creating debt. You let them free and say, create as much debt as you like. They'll create too much debt for this system, and then it crashes when the debt burden gets too high. And we've seen that in Japan, we've seen it in America, and we're now seeing it in China.
Now, we've seen a lot of finger-pointing at China over the last couple of weeks, and that sort of implies that our economy is healthy. Is that the case?
No. You've actually just been through a bubble before China did. I'm looking at a graph right now of private debt to GDP, and of course, private debt's where all these things happen. It's not government debt that where it matters, it's private debt. But England had a debt bubble that pretty much you can say began at the time of the Big Bang back in the 80s, slumped after the 1990s, and then from 1997 on, you had a increase in your private debt in England from 120% of GDP to 200%. That peaked in 2010. It's been heading down ever since. That's partly why the economy has been stumbling. What the Chinese have done is they had, starting until 1990, they had a pretty much constant debt ratio of about 100% of GDP. And then when the financial crisis hit, their solution was to tell their banks to lend like buggery to anybody with a pulse in China. And private debt in China went from being in 2008 being 100% of GDP, it rose to 180% at the beginning of this year. That's an 80% of GDP increase of debt in, you know, something like 7 years. It's the fastest rate of growth of private debt in human history, and that's what's caused the, in some ways, that underwritten demand in the rest of the global economy, because that extra debt was extra demand as well, and now that's come to an end. So it's, you know, whenever you have an out-of-control financial system, it's great while the party's going, while the debt's being extended, but the hangover comes when you've got to pay it back.
So is there going to be an international crash in September?
Not necessarily, because it's been unwound. Like the levels have been of debt have been slightly unwound in the rest of the West, and they're now, it's more like you've got the stagnation situation that Japan's been in. But there is a crash in China, and it's certainly by no means, it's only just started in China.
Well, that sounds pretty prescient to me. As an academic, I think he's quite careful about making predictions about whether things are going to crash, because you can always be held responsible if you get it wrong. But
well, he's keeping an open mind there, isn't he? He's saying not necessarily, probably not a crash in September, but he's actually, no, he won't come down one side of the fence or the other, which is the responsible attitude.
Yeah. But I mean, I think that isn't it interesting? We're talking about the long-term economic plan in Britain, which involves cutting benefits so that 2,000 people are found fit to work and then die in the next 6 weeks. Meanwhile, of course, the real world is a crash in China. And the reason why the Chinese are having a crash is because they expanded their economy to cope with the crash which happened in Britain and the US.
Actually, let me just correct you there. More than 4,000 died within 6 weeks of being deemed fit for work. That's the government has revealed finally this week over several years. Mike, what's your take on the global stuff, and how confident are you that we're going to be able to see it through the year into next year without some sort of catastrophic crash? Because, you know, you look at house prices. We've just had the figures through here from Bristol. I was reading the Bristol Post the other day. The house prices are higher than ever and still climbing, and yet the actual number of people able to buy is going down at an incredible, I think it's something like 20% of last year, less people actually able to buy.
The market is inherently unstable. I mean, that's the very nature of the thing. And unfortunately, we've lost our ability to control the market. Government doesn't seem to feel that it's the servant of the people anymore. It feels that the market is predominant over people, and there really has to be a concerted effort amongst the international community to get the free market under control and to get it working for society again.
But anybody that does... Well, the banks just say, well, we're leaving, we're going to go somewhere else.
There are major power blocks in this world. The European Union is a substantive power block, and nobody could afford to walk away from the European Union, apart from maybe Mr. Cameron, okay, and feel that that was a sensible or pragmatic thing to do with the size of the market that's available to them. So, you know, they've got a man up and play the game properly.
But they would probably say, well, actually, the European Union do what we tell them to.
Well, at the end of the day, it is human beings who elect those representatives, and they're there to serve those people, not to serve the interests of those people who own capital in the markets.
But, I mean, the European Commission isn't elected, is it? It's appointed. I mean, we elect the MPs who are there, and they're able sometimes to stop the laws, but the laws are introduced by the Commission, who no one's elected.
And the sooner we get to the evolutionary stage where the Commission is historic and the Parliament takes over the powers that it should do, the better.
I think that's probably right. I don't think that walking off out of the European Union solves any problems. The banking systems, I stress week after week, and Steve Keane would agree with me, the banking system is shot to pieces. It's no way fixed, and therefore being in or out of the European Union is largely irrelevant.
Martin,
if HSBC collapses, it won't make any difference whether we're in or whether we're out.
You've described them as suicide bombers, these bankers. Why is that?
Well, because what they're able to do, and what they've done in Greece, for example, and elsewhere, is they say, if you don't do what we want, we will collapse, and you can't have that. And that's what happens if you bail them out. Milton Friedman pointed this out years ago, why you shouldn't bail out failing industries, because it's not just a one-off payment. They then come back for more and more and more. And what the banks have done is they've taken all the money that's been chucked at them, and then they've used that money to lobby governments for further payments.
Well,
I mean, what's happened with RBS, if they sell off at the price they're selling it now, is that the British taxpayer will lose 12 billion quid. And the shareholders of RBS, who are largely the wealthy classes, have had their shares bought off them at one price. They can use that money to buy those shares at a lower price at a profit to themselves of 12 billion quid. Meanwhile, as we say, people are dying because they're being denied benefits.
I mean, it doesn't get pointed out enough, does it, that the bailout actually really only helped the bank shareholders. The depositors who have more than what the government protects, which is around something like £20,000-£25,000 of your deposits, anyone that's got more than that, like an astronomical amount in their bank account, or bank shareholders, they were the only ones who are actually helped by this bailout. Everyone else wasn't. Anyway, a couple more stories before we leave the subject of the economy. First of all, City Tycoon makes £225 million from the Great Fall of China. This is in the Daily Mail. A man who predicted the credit crunch strikes gold again after gambling the stock market would fall. So he made 225 million quid out of Black Monday last week. And also, former Gordon Brown advisor, Damian McBride, he's saying we should stock up on canned food ready for the stock market crash. Mick?
We really have to get this under control. We've got to a stage, and it's always been the case, I suppose, that if you're poor, the way to get you to do the right thing or to do more is to use a stick. If you're wealthy, the way to get people to do more is to offer them a carrot. And I've never really got my head around that. I think quite the reverse is true. Some people are making huge amounts of money out of imposing misery on whole countries. I think it's quite shameful.
Now, I know you've criticised the way Gordon Brown dealt with the 2008 crisis many times. Should we listen to his advisor, Damian McBride, over stocking up on canned food?
I don't think stocking up on canned food is going to help you if there's a crash and a world war, which is what we're talking about. This guy that bet against the market, when he made his money in 2008 when the market crashed, he then wrote a book about how he'd made the money, and he was a famous celebrity and all the rest of it, because he'd been regarded as a bit of a maverick up to that point. And in the book, he then meets with his fork, because he'd resigned from a major bank in order to run his own business. And he went to dinner with the guy that used to be his employer. And he said, well, and the guy who used to employ him said, well, you've done very well for yourself. You're very famous now. How much are you worth? And he said, well, I'm worth twice that for getting it wrong. Who's the mug, me or you? Because, of course, the bailout meant that the banks that got it wrong, where the people that did that got more money than the people who bet right.
Rewarded,
and that's what's wrong
rewarded
with the
system. Rewarded for failure. Interesting. Anyway, I said we're going to finish with those subjects, but there's one more. The Ukraine crisis. Creditors are to write off 20% of Ukraine's debt. This is yesterday. The Ukrainian government says it's reached a debt restructuring deal with its creditors, including a write-off of up to $3.8 billion. That's £2.5 billion. They're very happy, Martin.
Well, two things about this. One, it won't help them because their economy is absolutely in a mess. Secondly, of course, it's all political, isn't it? The Ukrainian government is an ally of the West, provoking the Russians, creating all sorts of problems, but they're good guys, so they get their debts restructured. The Greeks, on the other hand, they're bad children, and they're not allowed to have any debt restructuring. So the only times debts have ever been properly cancelled in recent times is a 50% cancellation of Egypt's debt in the run-up to the First Gulf War, and a 50% cancellation of Poland's debt in the 1990s. Both to do with political decisions taken by the US, etc. So the even money isn't money. There's no free market. It's all basically stitched up by the big boys.
Well, we're going to hear from one of Yanis Varoufakis from Syriza Party's top advisors in part two with his view of what's going on there. But now let's have a look. I mean, we mentioned the 4,000 that had died within 6 weeks of being deemed fit to work by the government. government. But also, Mike, we've got a benefits shake-up apparently going on. This is last week's story, Monday 24th of August, and this is in the Guardian. Ian Duncan-Smith, the Work and Pensions Secretary, is poised to announce a radical reform of sickness benefits that the government hopes will force up to a million more disabled people into work.
It's the word forced, isn't it? I think if you look at any of the work that these people may be fortunate enough to gain, it's going to be low paid, insecure work. It means they're living on a breadline and having to make far more effort just to stand still. I think it's an absolutely shameful abuse of the social responsibility that the government should have for the most vulnerable in society.
But he's got to cut the welfare bill by 12, he calls it the welfare bill, I call it the social security bill, by £12
billion. £12 billion is a drop in the ocean compared to the £350 billion that we've supported the banking system on. I think we've just got things round the wrong way.
Martin?
Well, £12 billion that he's got to save is exactly what the taxpayer will lose on the sale of RBS at the price that the government's decided to sell it at. This is all political, as we said earlier about the Ukraine. It's a political decision. And, of course, they're not going to save much money by cutting benefits for these people. It's just it's political grandstanding. They think that they can win in the marginal constituencies by demonising the poor, the vulnerable and the disabled. But I hope that the British people are strong enough and better than that, and that they will react with revulsion to this. At the same time as these people are dying, literally. I mean, I met a young man who was trying to get a job in a pub, who just had an operation for spinal cancer, and he was going to have another operation for spinal cancer 7 months later. He'd been told he'd got to get a job in a pub or something like that, and he could barely walk. Now, that boy is possibly dead now. And that's going on at the same time as the bankers are basically involved in criminal activity. That one trader was sent down for 14 years the other day. He wasn't really responsible. The people at the top should be sent down for 14 years. And this is just getting beyond a joke. And, of course, in terms of internal Labour Party politics, I think there's not been a sufficiently robust response to this welfare attack from our leaders. They've been craving about it.
Apparently, benefit claimants actually think that the new sanctions are a good thing. The only trouble is the quotes are all made up. This is from a Department for Work and Pensions leaflet, making up quotes, completely fictional individuals and stock photos from a picture library of anonymous people they gave names to. Jeremy Corbyn said the fact that the DWP has had to make up quotes from benefit claimants saying sanctions are helping them, presumably because they can't find anyone who says they are, not only shows how much out of touch the Tories are, but also affects their ideologically driven policies are having on people's lives. A DWP source said that Ian Duncan-Smith would not have had any knowledge of the leaflet before it was published.
I think it's absolutely appalling. We are punishing the poor for a banking crisis. That's the reality of the situation. And we really do have to have a paradigm shift in the political debate in this country. And I think with what's happening in the Labour Party at the moment, I think we're moving in that direction, to be honest.
So what's happening with the leadership election? Which way are you? You're obviously a Labour councillor, a Labour Party member. You are allowed to vote, I take it, because quite a lot of people have been told they can't.
Well, at the moment, I'm still allowed to vote. my heart is going with Jeremy, but it is a question of where the people of Britain will allow us to go.
I noticed a story in the Morning Star was saying there's the process by which vetting's been taking place of those who are and are not allowed to vote actually might be legally questionable.
We've made a real pig's ear of it, there's no doubt about it, but a more important thing is that a debate within the Labour Party has moved into an area that will actually challenge the existing free market orthodoxies that are in operation at the moment, that demonise the poor and celebrate those people who brought the banking crisis to us in the first place.
Martin, Mark Steele, the comedian who's on Question Time quite a bit, he went out helping campaign with his local Labour Party candidate in the recent election, and yet he's told you're not allowed to vote. You're trying to infiltrate the Labour Party.
Same thing happened to Brian Eno, and what they said, Brian Eno, the musician, and of course he's never got any. There's no evidence that he's ever been in support of any other party than the Labour Party, and if you've got people joining the party, you've got no other party affiliations. I mean, I can understand why you might say that Green Party activists shouldn't be allowed to vote in a Labour Party election, But on the other hand, I think this is all basically, they're all terrified because a proper debate has opened up. And I think the real debate is going to be about the economics.
Well, you say terrified, but is the establishment terrified of Jeremy Corbyn?
I think that the real problem, what we've really got to do is change the terms of the discussion. The idea that by trimming, I mean, I think it was fairly clear with what happened with the welfare bill. The Liberal Democrats, for goodness sake, had voted, all eight of them, bless their cotton socks, against the welfare bill. But the Labour right wing couldn't bring themselves to vote against it.
Well, it was the Labour leadership.
Yes, but of course Jeremy Corbyn and the campaign group, as always, voted against the wrong policies. I think if he wins, he's rebelled against party policy 500 times, I understand, in his career, so he may find that he's got some difficulties whipping the right wing into line.
Well, you can see why many of the people accuse him from within the Labour Party of basically will be running a kind of protest party.
I think what we've got to do is completely change the terms of the debate, including changing the political system. This is what happened in the 1980s in New Zealand. The Labour Party split because the right wing of the Labour Party believed in neoliberal economics and the left wing didn't. And ultimately that marriage had to end, and it did end. And the trade unions and the left wing of the Labour Party split the party and forced through PR. And then they formed alliances with other progressive forces in New Zealand, the Maori nationalists and the Greens, and one of the first things they did was renationalise the railways, for example.
One of the things
we've got to go down that road.
One of the things that fascinates me about all this is just how rattled the establishment is getting about Jeremy Corbyn. We're talking about 5 years before he could probably, or well, certainly possibly, take power. It's just that they don't seem to want his ideas in the national debate.
Well, that's exactly right. That's what they're panicking about. Not that he's going to be a big challenge to them electorally. It's intellectually that he's going to challenge him. And in actual fact, all of these economists like Steve Keane, who wrote to the newspapers supporting Corbyn's policies, the university economics departments are stuffed with people who think that George Osborne's an idiot. But of course, many people in the Tory party don't think so.
Well, we're going to go change tack a little bit now and going to have a listen to an interview which aired about nearly 2 weeks ago on BBC Five Live. It's a pretty shocking interview, and what it does is it looks at a particular individual called Joni Cameron Blair. It's an interview with her, and she's a former care home resident turned care home inspector up in Nottingham, and she discovered two things. One was child abuse on an industrial scale, she says in the interview, and the other is that rather than actually acting on the inspection reports that she was doing into these terrible things going on in children's homes, her reports were used then as a way of covering up, so a way of sort of warning the people in charge of the care system that something might go wrong, and people were not moved from their places. So anyway, let's have a listen now to this pretty shocking interview conducted by the BBC with Joni Cameron Blair, and I'll put a link up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later this evening to the full interview.
I witnessed a young lady being raped. I witnessed children being denied food. I witnessed children being force-fed food. I witnessed children being beaten on a regular basis with absolutely no controls in place at all. I witnessed children having psychological games played against them. Children routinely ran away only for staff members to set their watch by them and take bets on how long it was going to be before the police brought them back. When police brought them back, that would be announced to all the children in the unit as a warning as to what would happen, that you would only be brought back. Just some very, very, very cruel, cruel behaviour towards children. It was sickening. It was truly sickening to witness.
At the time, did you speak up? When you
absolutely
got out of Beechwood, did you go out? Did you talk to your family? Did you talk to the authorities?
I think my family knew. It was a pretty traumatic experience for me, but I, to be honest with you, Claire, I couldn't really talk about it. I couldn't discuss it. I wasn't there for that long, thankfully. My mother managed to get me out. It was after I left Beechwood, and you grow, you become educated, you get married and have your own children and your own family, and you look back, and it's as you grow and develop your morals and principles, that's when I began to realise what happened to me was just absolutely wrong, and what happened to those children was just absolutely staggeringly awful. And I set about wanting to help in some way. First of all, I wanted to go into the medical profession, but I changed direction when I heard an interview come up on advertised on the radio for people to come forward who had specific care experience to join the inspectorate. That was when I made the application and I got the post.
So you became one of the inspectors who would go into places like Beechwood?
The first years, it was probably about 1994 to 2000. There were rare cases of good children's homes. They were mainly quite bad. Not all as abusive as Beechwood, but there were many as abusive. But I initially started off into the county. I wasn't working for the city at that time. And I was not just dealing with children's homes, I was dealing with older persons' homes, respite care units and so forth. So I was across the board in the care sector. The city and the county then divided, and then I moved into the city, when that's when I started really sort of inspecting the city homes, and that was when I became extremely alarmed as to what I was witnessing. I first raised my complaints within the inspectorate approximately 95 to 96. I was taking my concerns to my superiors, and it wasn't until about 18 months when I started documenting people's behaviour towards children. And I was going back maybe a year later or 2 years back to that same home, because it didn't always happen annually. Sometimes it could be 2, possibly 3 years. And I would go back and I would see the same members of staff still working there, despite me feeding back my concerns and complaints. And then I also noticed that my reports would be doctored and manufactured, and my verbatim would be removed. And I began to question this practice.
What was going on, do you think?
Though I think there were lots of contributing factors, to be honest with you, Claire. I think a lot of it was about reputational protection. A lot of it was about protection for insurance company, the insurance company. A lot of it was about the hierarchy protection of their own personal positions, pay and pensions. It certainly wasn't protection for children. I certainly didn't see any protection for children, despite the numerous concerns and complaints that I was taking to the inspectorate. I then took my concerns away from the inspectorate because I realised that no action was taking place. So I then took it to the panel. The panel consisted of the chief executive of Nottingham City Council, the director of social services and the assistant director in social services, and a lot of other, you know, top people. And it was during these meetings that I ensured that my concerns were minuted. I needed documented proof that I was sharing my concerns, and still no action was happening. And when I challenged that action, and when they said to me and announced to me on that panel that they would be having investigations, I would no sooner get home, and within days of addressing the panel, they would cancel those meetings and cancel those investigations. I mean, it was just quite staggering. I was just banging my head against a brick wall, and for the life of me, even today, I don't know why.
That's Joni Cameron Blair there, interviewed by Claire McDonnell on BBC Five Live. Now, Martin, this is pretty shocking stuff going on in Nottingham. I would imagine that Nottingham is not the only place this is happening. Actually, someone there who's been herself witnessed a serious abuse going on in care home when she was a child is then an inspector. She's going around inspecting care homes, and then she's finding that rather than acting on the criticism that she's showing after having interviewed staff and children in those homes, she then goes back to find that no one's been moved, and actually it's just been used as a way of warning senior staff that perhaps they need to institute a cover-up.
Well, I think anybody, any objective person listening to that would say, well, there's some problem here that needs to be addressed with the institutions. But I would also like to point out that there are certain people in this society who don't count for anything. disabled people we were talking about earlier, people who are dying. And of course, young people, if they haven't got a family background where they're supported and helped and encouraged, are definitely not, they're not going to be looked after by the society properly. And of course, you know, we got the government talking about removing all benefits for under 25-year-olds, and that they've got to get work or do something with their lives. And that's just totally unrealistic when you think about children in care, even when the care itself is actually genuinely supportive rather than damaging, as in this case. And there's a whole hidden Britain which the people in power don't seem to have any conception of.
Mike, Joni there is talking about protection for insurance companies. She's talking about protection for pensions and pay of senior staff, but no protection at all for the children.
At the end of the day, there has to be some kind of democratic accountability on this. We've had this common mantra of rolling back the state year on year, and we haven't got the leverage now to get back in there and actually control it, because that's what needs to be happening. We need to look after the most vulnerable in society. It is a basic human right that they should be treated with dignity and respect, and the drive to get taxpayer value for things is really manifesting itself in horrid conditions for the people who have to rely on those services.
But how would you intend to do that? What changes need to happen? Because, I mean, you know, all councils have got chief executives. They're all on rather nice pay, and it might be that they would rather protect someone who's a head of social services than act and get bad publicity.
At the end of the day, and we live in a resourcing bubble that makes it very difficult to put funding in there, but we have a moral responsibility to challenge bad behaviour and to bring it into the light and get the strictest penalties possible imposed on those people who are abusing our most vulnerable citizens.
Yeah, but it seems the priorities are around the other way, aren't they? We're looking after the insurance companies and worried that we don't want to have to claim on the insurance or up the insurance payments on a particular children's home, for example.
At the end of the day, it requires investment, and that is a choice that the British people have to make in a general election or in their local elections, for that matter.
I agree with that. I mean, Joan Lester, the former MP, during the 1980s, I remember she was in the House of Commons, and she was making a speech, and she pointed out that the age of prostitutes in Britain had fallen year on year during the Thatcher era. And it was a kosher piece of research which showed that they'd fallen from being, you know, late teenagers to being early teenagers. And the Tories on the other side were laughing. And what she said at that stage is, you wouldn't be laughing if it was your children. And they wouldn't.
Well, we'll be talking more about the VI paedophile scandal in the second half. But there's also the matter here, maybe you first on this, Martin, which is that many of these cases have been reported to the police. Many of the police will have spoken to these children, for example, as they're bringing them back to a care home, and yet not acted on it. So the police surely are partly responsible for where we are today.
Well, as the VIP paedophiles, you've obviously got high-level protection for those involved, including, for example, senior police officers potentially being involved. I mean, the stuff that's coming out this week with Harvey Proctor, there were head of MI5 and MI6 were supposedly involved in the abuse. Now, when you've got that level of people involved, then it's going to be covered up. And as I've said before, the VIP paedophiles, I suspect this is the intelligence services using paedophilia as blackmail, like at the King Corrib Boys Home in Northern Ireland. But you've also got to accept that even in the public sector, there is going to be attempts to cover things up if things go wrong. It's not just insurance companies and so on. There's always a tendency for people to cover their own backs. Well, and that will be true even if everything
is properly
public.
We'll get Mike's take on this in a minute, on the police angle, you know, whether the policing has been up to scratch. After we've heard a clip from Radio 4 last Sunday, and this is Chief Constable Sir Peter Fahey talking on the Sunday programme in the morning on Radio 4, where he's talking to Edward Sturton about, I mean, hopefully anyway, policing having improved over the last 30, 40 years of his career.
officers were perhaps at an earlier stage in the 60s and 70s themselves trapped in a legal system and a police system which didn't allow them to speak out. But again, this is a very difficult issue, isn't it, about judgment, is that, you know, I've been a police officer 34 years. When I started, the system was very, very different in terms of, you know, I'll be honest, we were almost encouraged to tell lies in a court because we had a crazy system of the way that we didn't actually record interviews and we stood there in the witness box and supposedly gave verbatim records of accounts of a 20-minute interview. So, you know, you've also, this is a difficult issue about judgment. When you know what the system was like in those days, people will judge, you know, officers from this point now.
Just pick you up on that. You're really saying that as a young police officer, your superiors encouraged you to lie?
Well, it wasn't just police superiors, it was the whole legal system. It was the magistrates, it was the solicitors, it was the judges, because in those days, Edward, there were no tape recording of interviews. You perhaps interviewed a suspect for 20 minutes in terms of, did you commit this crime? And you went and stood in a box, in the witness box, and said that your record made after the interview was a verbatim record of what that criminal said. Now, everybody in that courtroom must have known that that was physically impossible to actually do that. But you were in a system that sort of connived in that and seemed to accept that. And I think that caused a lot of dilemmas for police officers at the time.
And a temptation, surely, if you were pretty sure that he or she was guilty, to make the record fit that view.
Absolutely. And we know that that went on. And so, you know, that was how it felt the system worked in those days, you know, when I first joined. And
did you ever do it? Did you ever tell
an untruth? No, I didn't. I never did tell an untruth. But on the other hand, as I say, I had to sit down and make a record of an interview and try and remember what had happened in a 20-minute interview, which was bound to have some inaccuracies within.
Well, they're quite shocking, aren't they, really? I would say that to give confidence now, we have to be invested in services to support people who have been through these experiences, and the police are not in a position financially to be expanding their services. The narrative is you spend less, and the reality of the situation is complex cases like this will go down the leg side, which is a shameful situation to be in.
I think that there has been a change in the culture of the police since that era.
Well, but there's been a change certainly in the way interviews are conducted, for a start.
But I think when people get nostalgic about Britain as it used to be, they need to remember that what Britain as it used to be was like was rubbish. And it's getting worse even as we speak, because we've got a government that wants to take us back rather than take us forwards. They've got a Victorian mentality. I mean, and if anybody thinks that life in Victorian Britain or even in the early part of the 20th century was rosy for ordinary people, then they're completely deluded.
Martin, I mean, you're always accusing the intelligence services of being criminals of all sorts of descriptions. And also, of course, we've got the VI paedophile scandal going on now. We're being encouraged, many people are being encouraged, saying, well, actually the police has changed. Would you agree that the police is better now, and that it's actually, because of the Jimmy Savile scandal, largely has opened up the possibility of actually getting something done about this?
We've got, even if the police are corrupt and lacking in morals and all the rest of it, you don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. The goal has got to be that the police are, in fact, doing a proper job, and where they're not doing a proper job, we've got to hold them up to scrutiny. And I think that the proper police investigation, things like the Kinkora Boys Home in Northern Ireland was being used by MI5 as a honey trap. They've got various political figures in there and paramilitary figures having sex with underage boys, and they're being blackmailed. That is all criminal activity, and the local police force, the PSNI, should prosecute those concerned, no matter who they are.
On to another story now. In a car hacking scandal, this is an exclusive in The Independent, not really picked up by the TV, the broadcasters at all, how a security loophole has left thousands of vehicles vulnerable to thieves. Tens of thousands of cars are vulnerable to thieves using electronic hacking, according to researchers whose findings were suppressed by a major car manufacturer for 2 years. The full details of the security loophole, which can now be revealed, show a widely used electronic security device designed to prevent thieves from breaking in and driving off with the vehicles could easily be disabled by criminals. So the criminals knew all about this, Steve, but Audi Volkswagen, Fiat, Honda and Volvo. Hang on. They're the vehicles that have this system. And I think it was Volkswagen. Yeah, Volkswagen used lawyers to close the research down. So the criminals knew they could do it, but none of the people who were with the Volkswagens and these other cars, Volvo, Honda, Ferrari, Porsche, Maserati, Fiat and Audi, were allowed to know that there was this flaw.
Well, with the greatest respect, and I mean, it's been a theme of a lot of what we've talked about today, most business doesn't run on any kind of moral framework. It runs on a cost-benefit analysis framework. And if it's going to cost them money to put right, they're going to try to avoid it, aren't they?
I think that's right. And I think also the capacity to use new technology to infiltrate people's personal lives.
Well, how this worked,
dangerous.
Let me explain how it worked. The researchers showed it was possible to electronically listen to signals sent between the security system and the key fob, the car's security system and the key fob. By doing this, they were able to discover the vehicle's secret code within just a few minutes. The academics warn security devices were vulnerable to close-range wireless communication attacks, situations such as valet parking and car rental, where attackers could have access to both the immobilizer and the keys, were a particular danger. The device is used by a total of 26 car manufacturers, but people weren't allowed to know, even though these researchers were trying to tell people, watch out. Effectively, they were told by the lawyers, you're not allowed to speak about a word about it.
Well, it kind of undermines everything that the car manufacturers have been trying to do, hasn't it? This high-tech stuff all becomes a liability instead of an asset. It's, you know, that's why they don't want, that's why
I
they
mean,
don't
it's
want
protecting
to
the
that.
Sales of these security devices as well, even though they're insecure. Amazing, really. Anyway, Bristol is becoming a more racist city, according to police hate crime figures. This is the 18th of August in the Bristol Post. Racially motivated hate crime is on the rise again after 3 years of improvement in Bristol and the surrounding areas. Figures obtained through a Freedom of Information request showed a rise in the number of hate crimes in Bristol postcode areas, including parts of North Somerset and South Gloucestershire. Police recorded 1,130 crimes in the area in 2010, but that dropped to nearly 100 cases by 2011 to 1,045. There were further improvements in 2012, but the now figures are heading up again, Martin.
Well, I mean, if you look at what you see in the tabloid media every day, and the antics of some members of UKIP, it's not surprising that you're going to get this kind of response by stupid people who ought to know better.
Isn't it just a result of the widening of the chasm between rich and poor?
Well, people are looking for scapegoats. I mean, the migrant crisis, which we discussed a couple of weeks ago with Leslie from the Conservative
Party.
Leslie Alexander. That's clearly a major issue all over Europe and a major issue for us. But, of course, the reporting of it is a sensationalist and incendiary, and therefore has some responsibility for when racist attitudes are reinforced to the extent of leading to assaults and other problems.
Mike, why is racist crime in Bristol on the up again?
We're in a very difficult and testing economic environment where everybody's struggling to get through, and there's been a general demonisation, be it of people on benefits, be it of people who are different, be it blaming it on immigrants. And it is a tabloid narrative that fundamentally clouds the fact that it is something wrong with the way we organise society that is the problem, and not individual victims of it.
So is there any light at the end of the tunnel?
There's always light at the end of the tunnel, because at the end of the day, I have inherent faith in the goodness of the British people.
Final story. Queen is going to eclipse Victoria's milestone. The Queen is set to become the longest ever reigning monarch in British history next year. Well, actually this year, sorry. On the 9th of September, she will pass the record set by her great-great-grandmother, Queen Victoria. Does that warm your heart, Martin?
Well, it doesn't warm my heart, but it doesn't make me feel particularly hostile towards her either. She's there. She's doing what she does. Let's hope we're not going back to what really worries me is the Victorian attitudes towards poverty and difference are becoming ingrained in our modern 21st century society.
Well, Mike, this is history, isn't it? The longest ever reigning monarch, the Queen, will be on the 9th of September.
If only other things were as stable in society.
Time now for the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks to this week's guest, Labour councillor for Brislington East, Mike Woolacott. After the Murdoch News, killing the host. How did we allow a parasitic financial system to grow up around us? Plus Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. And more of everything Britain's mainstream media doesn't want you to know after the Murdoch News at 6.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning...